Good morning, everyone. This is the NBC Newsroom in New York, Saturday, February 22nd. As this peaceful nation commemorates the birthday of the father of our country, we turn toward Europe, where the nations are at war. And for the war news from overseas, first, from London.
This is John McVane in London. For the third night in a row, German bombers last night hammered the Welsh city of Swansea. The attacks began soon after dark and lasted 3.5 hours. The raiders had to find their way through heavy anti-aircraft fire to drop their firebombs and high explosives. Once again, fires were started and houses, stores, and offices damaged. The first bombers dropped incendiaries. Later raiders followed with high explosives, and the attacks ended with another shower of firebombs. The casualties are not described as light. London had a single brief raid that began very late at night. A few bombs fell in the London area, but damage and casualties were slight. A fairly heavy anti-aircraft barrage lasted only a few minutes. One of the German bombers that raided Western England is reported to have been shot down by anti-aircraft. A Hurricane pilot saw it crash in flames. It was stated in London today that British bombers last night attacked targets in Western and Northwestern Germany. The invasion ports and airfields in German-occupied territory were also raided. A German report on the raids mentions Heligoland Bight as one of the places raided. The main targets attacked by the RAF, it stated in London, were Wilhelmshaven, Emden, and the French port of Brest. A large number of heavy bombs were dropped. Industrial objectives in the Ruhr were also attacked, but bad visibility made it impossible to observe details of the results. A large fire was seen at Wilhelmshaven. Two British planes are missing. A couple of hours ago, 14 German planes crossed the English Channel coast, but they were met by Spitfire fighters and driven back out to sea. Official circles in London have no confirmation today of the reports that the German entry into Bulgaria across the Danube has actually begun, but informed British quarters do expect that the open invasion of Bulgaria will begin in the next few days. It's thought possible that the more sensational reports of the German crossing of the Danube coming from non-Bulgarian sources may be part of the German war of nerves. However, it's felt that there are various signs that clearly point to the fact that the Bulgarian invasion is imminent. For some time, it's noted, the Germans have been quietly occupying various strategic points in Bulgaria. The cutting down of railroad traffic and the bridging preparations at certain places on the Danube are thought to show that the German move is near. While reports that houses have been requisitioned in Bulgaria as billets for German officers confirm the belief that the entry of the Germans is a matter of days, if not hours. British commentators today emphasize that Germany's attempt at bloodless conquest of the Balkans has up to now been only partially successful. The resistance of the Greeks and the firmness of Turkey, they say, have held up the German plans for many weeks. The Evening Standard says, quote, the Greeks have not been deceived, nor, despite the flood of German propaganda, have the Turks surrendered by their treaty with Bulgaria. The Greeks fight and the Turks stand ready. And so long as those two factors remain, Germany must take the course which she has always regarded as second best. That is, fight her way eastward instead of seeing the East collapse into her hands. The paper declares it isn't too late for other Balkan peoples to emulate the example of the Greeks, although the moment is slipping fast. But whether or not they choose the course of wisdom and glory, one fact is clear, the Standard adds. Germany missed her chance in the East. Last June, she could have marched eastward almost without opposition against a Britain in the East whose forces had been suddenly disarrayed. Today we have allies, better bases, a victorious army, and a fleet which rules the Mediterranean. A report reaching Britain from Belgrade today says that Hitler made three demands on Yugoslavia at his meeting with the Yugoslavian ministers at Berchtesgaden. They were that Yugoslavia join the Axis or acknowledge its control of Europe, that Yugoslavia allow German troops and war materials to pass through, and permit the Luftwaffe to use Yugoslavian air bases. And finally, that Yugoslavia maintain strict neutrality toward events in Bulgaria, Greece, and Turkey. Boiled down, the demands mean that Yugoslavia was asked to allow herself to be conquered by Germany without putting up a fight. However, Yugoslavian circles in London doubt that any demands made were put in such specific terms. These circles believe the Germans took a more general line. preferring to wait until later to tighten the screws. The British government today announced that a large area in the central Mediterranean, stretching from Italy to Benghazi, has been mined. This follows a similar Italian government notice. The British statement doesn't affect the notification issued in July that all ships navigating within 30 miles of any Italian territory do so at their own risk. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
We've just heard NBC's war correspondent bringing us the latest news from the besieged London capital. And now for our next stop, we bring you the latest news from the Reich. And we go to Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. Today, the Germans claim that British ships are sailing the seas disguised with the colors and flag of the United States. This accusation comes in today's German High Command report, just released. The Supreme Command tells the story of the British merchant ship, Canadian Cruiser, a vessel of 7,178 tons. According to the Germans, one of their sea raiders put this ship to the bottom in the Indian Ocean, presumably yesterday. The German version of this encounter is that the Canadian cruiser had the American flag painted on its sides. And when the crew saw the danger of the German radio, says their report, they ran up the stars and stripes in an effort to escape. But this maneuver apparently didn't fool the radio's captain, who gave the order to open fire. The ship sank quickly. At present, there are no other details, but they may come later in the day. The High Command bulletin tells of another sinking, but doesn't explain just where it occurred. But it seems that a U-boat, possibly operating in the Atlantic, torpedoed and sank a British merchantman of 4,350 tons. Still another British cargo boat, this one, a 4,000-tonner, is reported sunk in the east coast of England by German dive bombers. Off the west English coast, German bombers are said to have hit and damaged a steamer, two oil tankers, and other ships. This morning, when I ran through the sheets of the Dienstag Deutschland, an official German news service, I was surprised to find what is called Germany's strategic plan to win the war. You can well imagine, German military plans for the future aren't usually discussed so freely over here. So, to find them outlined in a controlled German press service, done up in tissue paper and ribbon, so to speak, leaves me somewhat perplexed as to why they're there. It seems to me that although these open plans may carry some indication of what may be expected in a general way, their publication today fits nicely into place in the new German war of nerves. Here's the purported German plan. I pass it on to you just as it comes to me. First, the Germans are convinced that an intensified U-boat campaign, coupled with mass action of the German Air Force and Navy, is sufficient to blockade the British Isles to the strangling point. Here, it's pointed out that although 296,000 tons of shipping is claimed by the Germans during the first 20 days of February, this figure is small compared to the tonnage expected to be sunk when the big action announced by Hitler gets underway. An indication that the time is not yet ripe can be seen in the statement that many U-boat crews are still making preparations for the campaign. In the second place, the Germans feel sure of wholesale successes in their air war against England. The war in the sky will also be intensified and directed mainly at British armament industries, communications, and British field positions. Thirdly, and this seems important, Germany will attempt a radical military solution of the Mediterranean problem at the exact moment when chances of a direct attack on England seems the best. And in this regard, the Germans consider invasion possibilities so numerous that it'll be impossible for the British to recognize mock action until it's too late. The Dienstag Deutschland sums up with a statement that while it remains to be seen whether or not the British forces go into action in the wrong places, the German viewpoint is that the smallest British harbor and the smallest English village will be more important to the final outcome of the war as a bridgehead for German invasion than Libya and even Abyssinia in British hands. Now that's what appears to be the plan the Germans have in mind to bring about a final victory for the Reich. As I said before, I pass it on to you for what it's worth. Getting back to what is actually happening in a military way, we learn here that last night the Royal Air Force made what is called by the German radio disturbing flights over German coastal areas in the German Bight.
The high command says that the enemy dropped incendiary and explosive bombs in places in north and western Germany. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
Next, the news at home. Earl Godwin reports from our newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Washington's farewell address will get another chance on Capitol Hill today because it will be a part of the Senate debate on the lease-lend bill. That historic address had a terrible time getting an audience in the House Thursday afternoon. John Rankin of Mississippi forced the speaker to call for a quorum because only 30 members sat listening at that time, and the quorum call barely stirred enough members from their offices to make the meeting official. If they had not found 219 members, the House would have adjourned in the midst of Representative Magnuson's reading of that famous classic, and the congressional record would show it. You know, which, by the way, that was never delivered as an address. It was written by the first president and handed to a Pennsylvania newspaper publisher who printed it as one of the first big scoops of the Western world. But other papers began to copy it and reprint it, and week by week, and really, imagine the speed, because in less than 6 weeks, it had circulated across the wild and rugged frontier of the Blue Ridge and the Alleghenies and was known even as far west as Ohio. Today, stress will be laid by opposing sides on various sections of Washington's address, the advice against permanent foreign entanglements, and the warning that the Republic had been led to freedom to avoid being too hateful or too friendly with respect to foreign powers. In the Senate, there is a lively cloakroom argument and discussion about the president's remarks yesterday at his press conference, wherein he raised the question of public morals, ethics, and patriotism following the leak in the Senate Military Affairs Committee, whence came the story that General Marshall, Chief of Staff of the United States Army, had told of strengthening Pacific bases and so forth and so on. That was inaccurate stuff that finally was printed and broadcast, said the president to his press conference, but it should not have been circulated anyhow. And Senator Shepard, chairman of the Military Affairs Committee, agrees with the president. Washington newspaper men discuss the possibility of a censorship. The president flatly expressed himself in opposition to any idea of a censorship. But Senator Wheeler of Montana, who, as you know, is a bitter opponent of the lease-lend bill, predicts a new censorship from Washington just as soon as the lease-lend bill passes. Wheeler said he saw evidence of a crackdown policy by the administration, not only in the attitude of officials generally, but in the criticism of President Roosevelt over disclosure of this purported secret testimony. Mr. Roosevelt's attitude, said Wheeler, is an indication of the trend of the administration, and they are trends that do not speak well for the continuation of the democratic processes, and so forth and so on. The government is adopting two new measures to strengthen its ties of friendship with Latin America. Purchasing officials here have decided to add more meat to Army and Navy diets, and some of this will be bought in South America, notably Argentinian canned beef. Defense officials reveal that arrangements have been made with 11 nations below the Rio Grande to develop rubber-producing facilities also. The Army is also arranging to make tremendous purchases of canned goods and non-perishable food, such as coffee and so forth and sugar. In addition, the Army seems to be worried about cooks to cook all this food. If it is true what they say in New York, the Second Corps area, where they seem to be really disturbed about it, are asking the restaurateurs to help, the Army is really offering careers to good cooks and promises that they can get as high as the grade of sergeant, and that their pay is better by an average of $3 to $30 a month, better than the average enlisted men and non-commissioned officers. Up to now, we've been hearing about the lack of Army flyers, but they're getting right down to the level now when they complain that they can't get enough cooks. Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's the news from Washington at this time.
And so ends this morning's report of the news. We've heard from our reporters in London and Berlin, and from Earl Godwin in Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.